Hello there, and welcome to the London Book Fair's LBF Talks podcast on EdTech, which is called Old School, New School, Technology, Textbooks and Teachers, The Changing Roles in the Classroom of the Future. And this is part of London EdTech Week, which runs this week. My name is Nick Kind. I am a strategy consultant that has worked with and continues to work with a range of education companies around the world. Prior to that, I spent 20 years developing educational software in a variety of ways. I'm delighted to introduce today Lyndon Harris and George Burgess, who will be debating this topic for the next half an hour or so with me, interrupting at various points. Probably best to start by both Lyndon and George themselves introducing themselves, and then we'll kick off. Why don't you start, Lyndon?
Okay. Hi, I'm Lyndon. I'm an independent consultant. I work with a range of edtech and educational publishing companies, a lot around market insights, digital transition, both in terms of developing content, but also looking at new markets and segments and usability, thinking very much about how to be using products and services and in what context. I've moved into being a consultant after 25 years of working in educational publishing and developing internally digital solutions.
Excellent. And George, you have a slightly different background.
Yes. Hello, Nick. And that was a wonderful introduction you did, by the way. So my background is I've been running an edtech startup up until very recently. I created Gojomo, which is a revision app for GCSE and A-level students in the UK. And that was acquired by the Telegraph Media Group earlier this year. So I'm now working with them in a consulting manner on their education strategy. I also run the EdTech Exchange, which is a networking and events business in the EdTech sector. So we help connect publishers and corporates with startups who are doing interesting things in the space. And we are also one of the co-hosts of London EdTech Week. So very excited to kick that off today.
Excellent. Thank you, George. So I'm going to kind of plunge us in at the deep end. I quite like asking awkward questions, as perhaps Lyndon and George will remember from our previous interactions. A favourite word with the sort of Silicon Valley technology community, and indeed with strategy consultants, as Lyndon and I will probably know, is the word disruption. I'm not convinced about the use of the word disruption all the time, but we've seen some pretty big players in the educational publishing world suffer quite dramatically in the last few years. Perhaps most recently and closest to home here in London, Pearson, which has experienced a pretty dramatic plunge in its share price. We've also seen a lot of venture capital money pour into education technology over the last few years, some of it for companies which are explicitly saying they aim to challenge the existing content companies. A broader question then, do you think that technology is disrupting education and educational publishers, and if so, how? George, maybe as the startup man in the room, you could start.
So that is an awkward question to open with. It's something I've actually been on reflecting on to some degree recently, having just kind of come out of the startup world myself. And I think it would be fair to say that technology has the potential to disrupt learning and education, but probably hasn't quite done so yet. I think there are structural issues, which we're all familiar with, which make education very tricky. That is the fact that you're selling to slow institutions, the nature of the teacher in the classroom, the different stakeholders that are involved. And that makes it one of the hardest sectors to actually disrupt in the truest sense of the word, and not just kind of iterate on digitally, which is what I think what a lot of the more kind of traditional incumbents would be doing. So, I mean, you mentioned Pearson. I don't think Pearson would see itself some people at Pearson would see themselves as a disruptor. I think it's safe to say that Pearson is not a disruptor. They do iterate on their way of delivering forms of educational content, but I don't think they're disrupting in the truest sense of the word. I think a number of startups look to do so, and again, haven't quite cracked it at the scale which they need to for us to safely say they're disrupting. This is the likes of kind of Newton, who were really at the forefront of the kind of adaptive learning movement and raised, you know, over $100 million. No one really knows what Newton is doing today, and I think it's safe to say they didn't quite achieve what they set out to originally. So I think there's a lot of room to go, and I don't don't think education has been disrupted yet. I think we are still at the very, very beginning of what will be a interesting decade, to say the least.
Lyndon, what do you think on that front?
I would agree with George. I mean, I think we would be naive to think that that technology and digital will not disrupt. We only have to look at almost any other sector and see what's actually happening there. One of the constraints I think we do face in the UK, though, is the fact that we still have a paper-based public examination system. And I think that does put a brake on some experimentation and some use of technologies, because it's harder to take a fully integrated and blended view right the way through to examination, when we know that actually, unfortunately, there's a huge amount of emphasis both within schools and obviously for individual students about getting those grades in the end. And so the disconnect between the paper-based examinations and the style of learning and engagement and assessment that can happen on screen and online, I think is a factor that's slowing things down, as well as the conventions. That's got to be one constraint in the UK. We are beginning to see clearly some interesting developments from other awarding bodies and curricula, like the IBO, that have organised their MYP curriculum to be to lead to on-screen assessments. And it'll be interesting to see how that works. That's clearly going to impact more in an international environment, but it will be interesting to see where that integrated model comes through. On a different level, I think that actually it has to disrupt. You know, we're producing young people who are going to be working in the clearly in a very digitally driven world, if not already digitally driven, and therefore actually that has to come into their experience of education within schools.
We should probably just quickly explain what MYP stands for those people who aren't experts on the International Baccalaureate.
Yes, my apologies. Sorry, Middle Years Programme is very much curriculum for the middle years of schooling.
Excellent. I mean, I think what, for me, around that question, the issue is, personally, I don't think technology is the thing that is doing the disruption. It is a number of the market forces which have happened, partly because of the impact of technology on society, partly because of the possibilities that technology gives us, and partly for a range of other reasons. I would argue that, you know, the travails that Pearson are currently encountering, the trouble that they're currently having, is as much to do with the fact that there is a real crisis in the value of higher education in the US as there is, as it is to do with the possibilities presented by technology and offered by technology. One of the things I'm hearing from you, Lyndon, and indeed from you, George, is that this whole market, many educational publishing markets, indeed most, I would argue, are driven by external factors, notably the policy of governments. And I think one of the issues is that perhaps publishers don't either acknowledge that fully or try and force agendas of their own on those governments, which they may or may not actually want to make happen. And I'm interested to hear, A, your comment on that, and B, given this sort of slightly dynamic situation, how agile and how able do you, how well equipped do you think are the publishers of the early 21st century to deal with the sort of the difficult set of things which are affecting the industry as we find it? Lyndon, again, probably one for you as you come from the conventional publisher, then we'll get an external view from George.
Yeah, I think actually one of the interesting things in one sense, I think we're also having seen so much consolidation in the educational publishing industries. In some ways, I think that is also maybe reinforcing a status quo, and also that they've got, as Pearson found, when you've got an enormous amount of revenue and profit from legacy type revenue streams, whether that's print or, you know, relatively straightforward online, it's quite difficult to really create the environment to be experimental and to work directly with schools and to really innovate. And so I think actually, whether it's through the ed tech or some new independents or different divisions within those publishers, I think actually it will be, we will see that innovation probably from very different perspectives and from different players. I think going back to what you say, I think the policy situation is clearly a driver, and I would agree. Pearson's issues in revenue issues, particularly in the US, are driven by a change in the higher education adoption model, and also from a very overpriced textbook market, which you know, it got to a point where I think students as well as institutions rebelled at the cost and the restricted nature of what the offerings were coming from the publishing sector.
George, I know that you've endeavoured to work with publishers both in the UK and globally. What's your perspective on this one?
Well, I think actually, Nick, what you said was quite interesting, which is there hasn't necessarily been technological disruption, but there is perhaps business model disruption. And Pearson has been, you know, one of the victims of that. I mean, if you look at the cost of textbooks, as Lyndon was referring to, I mean, the inflation on those over the last 10, 15 years, particularly in US higher education, has been absolutely insane. And so that's opened up opportunities for new businesses to arise. I mean, the likes of Chegg with their rental book model, that has meant Pearson now feels some pain as a result today. That is not kind of the technological disruption that we would think about in the startup venture capital world, but it is, of course, a change to the status quo and how it has been for a very long time. I think all of this comes back to some of the, you know, factors we were talking about earlier in terms of these many stakeholders, all with different responsibilities and different views, that just make it very, very difficult to innovate when it comes to technological change. And I'm afraid I can't remember the second part of your question because I was so interested in the peer.
Well, it was talking about, you know, I know you've endeavoured to work alongside with
publishers
and how well you think they are equipped for this changing world.
So I've been very vocal about this to the dismay of some people in the publishing world. And I certainly, I mean, in our experience, we found it extraordinarily hard to work with publishers. And in fact, ended up kind of going it alone and becoming our own content producer as a result. I originally know Lyndon from when she was at Cambridge University Press. And we spent many, 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 many months, potentially years, trying to work with Cambridge University Press. And I think we got somewhere, but we didn't get very far in the end. And that was the case, without wanting to put CUP to shame, with most publishers that we approached. And I don't think that's because there wasn't an appetite to work with startups or to try new things. I think it's because publishers, particularly some of these large organizations, by their nature, aren't set up to do the more innovative, unusual, risky type ventures that we would undertake as startups. You know, we want to move within 6 to 12 months, and we have a window, particularly if we're on a venture fundraising track, of only 12 to 18 months to get stuff done and show that we are worthy of more capital. And when you're working with more traditional publishers who are used to 24-month lead times, there's a fundamental cultural difference which makes it very, very difficult to work together. And so there are a lot of players and incumbents in the space who do try to work with startups, you know, get quite active in the edtech scene. I mean, and we support that as the EdTech Exchange. As part of the activities we do is connecting corporates with startups. But in terms of actually, you know, getting partnerships signed, getting deals done, and actually getting on with delivering something of value, it can be very challenging because of those cultural differences.
Yeah, I mean, and it's something I'm well aware of as I was involved in the establishment, as you will both remember, of a corporate venture unit in education for Macmillan. And there are often challenges for all sides in making that work, that model work really, really effectively. Sorry, and Lyndon, I can hear you were wanting to say something.
Yeah, no, sorry. I think one of the things, though, it goes back to that legacy situation, because I think in order to move forward, they need to be a different type of partnership. So, for example, and George will know this very well, is that actually there is an issue with publishers and existing content because of their existing range of ownership and royalty related IP situations. So it isn't as straightforward as being able to say, yes, we'd like to work together, here's the content, here's a licensed product, let's move forward. It's often that there is actually such a complicated, well, for external people, a complicated rights and remuneration arrangement connected to those content assets, some of which publishers definitely do not own, such as third-party images and other ones which they do, and running through and managing those rights streams and those income streams back to those rights holders can be more of a problem and an issue and an expense than the opportunity to go forward. That said, I think actually publishers do need to think differently and also have a less have a more partnership-driven approach, and to understand that actually working together, and I hate the word, but in some ways it makes sense, you know, the co-opetition, actually, that you know there are opportunities to work in collaboration both with EdTech but also a range of players. And I do wonder whether some of the systemic things will change in terms of the UK with the multi-academy trust and an opportunity to potentially for whoever, whether it's a startup plus a publisher or just, you know, a combination of those, to work with a multi-academy trust to really look at on the ground ways in which technology could really enhance and move forward students' learning in the context of the classroom and the school, and working together to really experiment on the ground and work iteratively to produce a different type of approach to teaching and learning using technology.
So that's really interesting. And in fact, I was going to sort of slightly switch tracks and try and become a little bit more positive here. You've outlined an interesting new way forward from one perspective. George, you know, you're at the hub of a group of companies and organisations and investors here in the UK. You also, as I know, have worked with people across the Atlantic and in the wider world. You know, what would you like to see happening? Are there some really good examples of things that get you excited? What, being more positive for a second, you know, what's making you sort of get up in the morning and think, oh, that's great?
Well, I think to Lyndon's point, there are a number of organisations who are really putting partnerships at the front and centre of what they do and using partnership as an opportunity to test and experiment. I always think one organisation that's done that reasonably well is Oxford University Press. They have a business development team who license out a lot of content to some fairly unusual, you know, startups in some cases, just to kind of see what they can do with it. And they, you know, they now sponsor the Emerge educational incubator as well and get quite involved in that. So there is a lot of interesting stuff happening in the sector, people investing money strategically sometimes, people teaming up to work together. And, you know, also to use the multi-academy of trust example, I mean, we have organizations like Assembly, which is essentially a non-profit startup, which stemmed out of difficulties that ARC were facing amongst their schools. So actually kind of they went and, you know, tried to tackle some of those issues themselves and then set that up as a standalone organization. So there is a lot of, I think there's a lot of effort going into this space. I think part of the problem is that even when those opportunities and partnerships do prove successful, they then kind of struggle to scale up. And that is really the kind of structural issues that we talked about earlier, more so than any sort of lack of effort coming from parties at either end of the spectrum.
So one of the things I've observed in this, I'd be interested in both of your perspectives on this, is that I think there is a fairly dramatic difference there between the British context and the American context, and scale is a very important part of that. It's not just about the scale of the market, which is a very significant factor, but it's also sometimes in my experience about the scale of people's ambitions, both from investors and from startups themselves. And again, I wonder if you felt that was the case, or if you felt slightly differently. Linda.
I think that's true. And I think one of the interesting, but equally, I don't think it's just happening in the States. I mean, I think we've got examples of some very interesting stuff that's happened in Australia. And in some ways, they understand they come from a smaller market. And that's always been true, whether it's been publishing or ed tech, that actually they look beyond their own shores to think about how they're going to scale up. But, you know, we've got an example in 3P and Mathletics, where it's a very interesting model that started very much as a consumer online maths service, and it's now, you know, moving into institutional. It's also thinking of partnership. It's made an interesting partnership and investment in Learnosity, which provides a range of assessment items that could be integrated into content and services, and an API-driven model. So it's a substantial business now in Australia, and they claim to be one of the largest maths online providers in the States. And obviously they've made inroads into the UK. So there are, as you said, positive examples of these things. I think thinking of the US, I think one of the big changes though was a change in their structure of funding, also some changes of policy, which enabled a shift from textbook driven funding, which had to be spent on textbooks, to opening up to being able to spend on any content and services, as well as places like California moving deliberately into a digital environment and away from print. And then the releasing of the policy, which enabled actually more personalised learning approaches to be picked up at a district level and a school level.
Yes, and I think one other place, you know, which we should also mention as an absolute powerhouse of educational technology investment at the moment is China, where we are seeing enormous amounts of money going into a range of very interesting startups, a lot around markets which have traditionally been the preserve of Western world publishers, if you like, particularly around English language learning. Sorry, George, I don't know if you were going to add anything on in there.
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things to say on the scale front. I think one of the kind of interesting things about the UK market is our kind of shift to academies and the academization. And that really has had an effect on the way that things are procured. So academization is fantastic for startups because it means you can be a two-man band with a really interesting product and you can get it into 10 schools because you can just go door to door and they do have, you know, the budget and the authority to buy that product if they like the look of it and make use of it. You then struggle, though, if you do have a successful product in scaling that up, because you still have to go door to door in order to sell to 4,000 or 5,000 secondary schools in this country. People talk about multi-academy trust as a solution to that, but realistically, if you look at the kind of spread in terms of size, there are very few of them who are large enough to have their own procurement team. And even when they do, they are typically going to the individual schools within their group to still get them to buy in and use the product. So I think the UK is a very interesting market and allows for inroads very, very quickly for small businesses, but actually can make it really, really difficult to scale. And, you know, you compare that to the US where they're buying at a district level, you could go out there and win millions of dollars worth of contract in a single purchase agreement. Now, that's a slightly long-winded and more challenging process and requires a slightly different set of expertise. But it can mean if you're at that phase of the business where you're just looking to scale, you can grow quite quickly. To come back to the kind of, you know, the global situation, I mean, I think China is growing and so many interesting things are happening there at such a rapid rate that it's actually starting to spill over and affect other markets as well. So here in the UK, we're actually seeing an increasing amount of investment in UK startups from Chinese funds and angel investors. And I haven't actually run the numbers, but anecdotally, I would say that's now more so than American funding coming into the UK, just because one of the advantages we have as a British education system is the British education brand, which does do very well in Asia. There is that kind of emphasis put on British education and all the kind of historic big brand names, the Oxfords, the Cambridge, the Eatons, that actually lend itself very well to exporting. And it doesn't do as well when you're going across the Atlantic. So I think the whole nature of the global education ecosystem, particularly when it comes to startups and how they can grow and investment and where it's coming from, is changing quite a lot right now.
I think picking up your, that's, I would very much agree with you. I think the other aspect about the impact of China and things happening in Asia, I think it's also one of the areas where we're really seeing a massive investment and usage of mobile, and also that is crossing over both the payments and the consumption platforms. So I think it's going to be really interesting about how that really changes the style and nature of the digital products and services that we end up producing. And it takes you back to the disruptor of influence, is that I think mobile is the potential to be, you know, the means by which disruption may well happen, and that we'll see some of the models that are happening in Asia may accelerate that in a way that I'm not sure it will. What's happening in the US is going down the mobile route. So there's two interesting different approaches, I think. I don't see districts really picking up on mobile and that approach, and also really covering both use within the home and use within in schools, as you're beginning to see in parts of Asia anyway.
Are there some particular examples of that you sound like you've done a lot of looking into this, Lyndon? Are there some particular examples, particular companies, particular contexts where you think, wow, that, you know, that's very exciting, that could easily travel over to the UK or elsewhere?
I think it's more in the sense of not specific. In some ways, I guess it's more the use of a whole range of open apps and that more integrated approach that's happening in terms of whether that's because of the single social media platforms that are integrate with the apps, integrate with the payments.
So the WhatsApp, the WeChat, yes. This world, for example.
Exactly, that world, yes. I think that's enabling a different approach because it's in one sort of ecosystem in a way that isn't quite the same in either Europe or the States. But perhaps George has got a perspective on that.
Well, I was just going to add that. I also think it's a cultural thing. You know, if you look at the kind of B2C market for education in Asia, it's vastly, I mean, not just because of size, but on a GDP or per capita basis, it's vastly bigger than it is in the Western world because we don't invest as much as households or as parents in our kids' education out of our own income as they do out east. And that does change the nature of who you're selling to, what the product looks like and how you deliver it, and actually means that mobile channels can grow a lot faster. I mean, it was very difficult for, I mean, Gojomo was a mobile-first product, and last year, we reached about 1 in 3 GCC and A-level kids. And that was only because it was delivered to their mobile phone, advertised through Instagram and Facebook. But as a result, it would be very difficult for us to get any uptake in schools because in many schools in this country, we're still kind of banning mobile phones and requiring that students keep them off and hidden. So there's a whole bunch of cultural facets that I think play into this, part of it being this B2C sales channel, part of it being just the use and adoption and acceptance of technology.
Okay, excellent. So we're coming to the end of our podcast. We've got a couple of minutes left. So if we just went around and said, you know, if there's one thing that you'd like to be discussed in London EdTech Week, given our conversation today, what would it be? Let's start with you, George, again. And I'm going to have my halfpenny worth as well.
So there's this, it kind of comes back to the conversation we were having about scale, and we didn't really talk about how that affects the kind of founder's mentality and also how that relates to fundraising. But I think it's really important because we see a lot of startups in the ed tech space, and unfortunately a lot of them will never get too far. And that's just for a variety of reasons. Part of that is because they go after such niche problems within what is already a fairly small sector, with a fairly limited amount to spend from institutions. So much so that if you ran the kind of total addressable market, you're looking at fairly small numbers. And if you work backwards, that means the funding that you will have access to will be very, very limited, and in often cases limited to kind of individuals who are willing to back your idea as opposed to institutional capital. And I think there needs to be more of a discussion at an earlier stage in the startup world relating to ed tech around what is backable at a large scale, what could be big, what could have a huge impact, what could raise large sums of money, and actually what maybe should just remain a project or a small limited UK business. Because I think often people enter this sector, they see a couple of other startups who've done fairly well, and they think they can go raise a few million dollars and build a big business, when in reality that is really, really, really tough to do, and is by far the exception rather than the norm.
Linda?
I very much endorse what George says. I think perhaps the area I would really like to see some focus on, and I think ultimately will make a change, is much more focused on the usability and the experience and needs of the actual users, particularly students. In the end, it's going to be, we're beginning to see more and more, particularly at higher education, but I think it's also coming down into schools, the students will vote with their feet. But equally, if we're really going to understand how to progress their learning and develop the 21st century skills that they need, and also to be honest, is also leverage the skills that they already have, that they're developing for themselves, is that we really need to focus as much, if not more, on their experience and creating products and services that really work for students and work in the way that really progresses learning and enables them to have feedback and assessment in meaningful ways that both enhance their experience, keep them engaged, and also progress their learning.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping we've got a little bit of time just for me to say that I would love to have a discussion about making data more interoperable to allow the startups and everybody to compete on a level playing field with the information that we're storing about students, because I think that could make some really, really exciting new possibilities. Both of you, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure to have you on this podcast, and I look forward to continuing the conversation some other time.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Nick. Thank you, Lyndon.